Hi, my name is Sarah Ash, and I'm a reporter-producer for the Texas Standard. I usually would not call myself a sports fan, but I grew up watching soccer. One of my favorite stories I've reported looked at how women's soccer specifically is growing in popularity in Texas and across the country. Listen anytime to the Texas Standard wherever you get your podcasts.
From KUT
and KUTX
Studios.
Which is the number one chocolate
drink? Two pizzas for the price of one.
A taste so wonderful.
That's a spicy meat.
Thanks for joining us for The Secret Ingredient, a podcast that takes you into the depths of food history and production. Produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas. This season, we're focusing on all things Green New Deal. We won't tell you who to vote for, but we will tell you why your vote is important. I'm Miles Bloxon, assistant producer for The Secret Ingredient, hosted by Tom Philpott, food and agriculture reporter from Mother Jones Magazine, Rebecca McEnroy of KUT Radio, and Raj Patel of the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs.
Today on The Secret Ingredient, our theme in this Green New Deal themed season is movement.
You know, let's be real. Like the environmental movement is a pretty middle class white movement filled with people whose lives are pretty good, who are scared about the future, right? It isn't filled with people whose lives are tangibly crap right now. I believe we're going to be nostalgic about the era when the right in the United States denied climate change, because the only thing scarier than them denying climate change is them not denying climate change.
What do we want? Climate justice!
Who better to lead us through this than Naomi Klein, who is a movement intellectual, an activist, an author, a filmmaker, the inaugural Gloria Steinem Chair in Media, Culture, and Feminist Studies at Rutgers University, and most important, author of the recently released On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal. Now, all of this you could have gotten from Wikipedia, but what you don't know is that Naomi and her partner, Avi, saved my life, because back in the day when we were young, I was doing social activist work in Zimbabwe and was terrified of the repercussions that might follow some of the work that I was doing. And Naomi and Avi not only taught me how to behave in front of the camera, but taped me describing some of the work that I was doing in case it was needed. Luckily, I got out in one piece. Not the same could be said for some of the people I was working with. But ever since then, I feel like Naomi has saved my life. And what's important about this book is that she is trying to do the same with everyone else, for everyone else, as we face the climate catastrophe. So, Naomi, thank you so much for coming and joining us here today on The Secret Ingredient. Let's begin by talking about the movement around the Green New Deal. One of the criticisms that has come up in our sort of talking through the Green New Deal is the bill calls for a Green New Deal movement, but where is it?
Right. So there is no Green New Deal. I think that's an important thing to be clear about. There's many versions of what a Green New Deal might be. There are many different definitions of what a Green New Deal might be. And it's also not a new idea, right? It comes out of decades of work from the environmental justice movement, the framing that as we deal with the crisis of climate disruption, if we deal with it justly based on who created this crisis and who's suffering the impacts, then we have a historic opportunity to right huge wrongs within our countries and between our countries. As you know, Raj, that's not an idea that was born last year in Washington, D.C. I mean, I first heard about it from an Ecuadorian, from friends in Ecuador who are part of a social movement called Acción Ecológica that we're talking about the concept of ecological debt and how the global north owed a debt to the global south because of centuries of extraction and because of the impacts, the unequal impacts of climate change. And that therefore there should be a redistribution of wealth that would help a country like Ecuador leave its rainforests intact, but still pull itself out of poverty, right? So it's not a new idea. It goes through different iterations over time. What is new is that there's now a cohort of politicians in the most powerful country on the planet who are championing this idea, and in so doing have taken large parts of the movement framing, left some of the others out, and movements continue to push and say, you left this part out, this part's wrong, and so on. So it's very, very much a work in progress. But in answer to your question of, where's the movement piece, the original idea when the Sunrise Movement, the youth-led climate justice movement, they proudly talk about building an army of young people that will demand responses to the climate crisis on the scale of the crisis itself. They occupied Nancy Pelosi's office, most famously, right after the midterm. And the response from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's office, the original response, not the resolution that she co-wrote with Ed Markey, the original idea was for there to be a congressional subcommittee that would be fully resourced for and spend an entire year doing consultations with movements, with subnational governments, with scientists to come up with the plan for a Green New Deal. And that was a really good idea that got crushed by the leadership of the Democratic Party. So now we have this principle of, we don't think we should hand this down from on high, which is absolutely correct. We want movements to democratically design this thing, but basically because we don't really have a left in this country. We have a lot of sort of NGOs and some groups that are trying to rebuild social movements, but we don't really have strong movement infrastructure. A lot of folks are kind of waiting around going like, I think I support the Green New Deal, but I don't know how to express that. Like, if you're 20, you can join the Sunrise Movement. But if you're 50 and, you're a nurse or a teacher or a farmer or in one of the sectors that would be, tremendously impacted, it's not necessarily that there isn't a desire to engage. There just isn't the infrastructure. And I don't think this is about blaming anyone, except you could always blame the leadership of the Democratic Party for these things. But I think that's where we're at, is we need to sort of, an editor once described the process of writing a book on a subject where the subject is changing very quickly. It's an experience I know you've had and I know I've had. Sarah Bushtell, she's a great editor. She describes it as hemming a dress while wearing it. And so I think it's sort of like we need to build the movements while designing the Green New Deal.
In addition to being a social movement process, there's also an electoral process tied into it because, obviously the vision is to get a bunch of legislation through Congress like happened in the 30s during the Depression. And there is, for the first time in my adult life, there is actual national candidates who are pushing ideas like this. And I wonder if you could just talk through a little bit the electoral part, the candidacies of people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, and also down ticket races, that for the first time we actually have candidates who are willing to push ideas like that, and how that can be used as an asset to movement building.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that in part because there are so many darn candidates, there's a kind of porousness between social movements and a lot of these campaigns where a lot of activists, who come out of very different social movements, whether they, some come out of Occupy, some come out of the migrant rights movement, some come out of, movements demanding, massive debt eraser. So a lot of them are actually working on different campaigns. The Sanders campaign, the Warren campaign, also previously the Jay Inslee campaign, which informed big part of how Elizabeth Warren is approaching the Green New Deal. She just sort of adopted a lot of Inslee's work wholesale. And Inslee's platform was the result of a huge amount of pressure from environmental justice groups in Washington state who had been pushing Inslee for a more justice-based approach to the climate crisis. He's always been very focused on climate, but in his sort of first forays, it was very sort of carbon-centric, and the first carbon tax he was proposing was not a just carbon tax. It was opposed by frontline communities of color in Washington state. And then when that failed, they then worked on a different carbon pricing plan that was justice-based, that would have taken a lot of the revenues, brought it to frontline communities so that they could invest in green infrastructure and so on. And so Inslee's plan is itself movement informed, right? So I don't think you have this really clean break between where the movements and the politicians. I think in a lot of cases, frankly, movements are writing these plans, in part because politicians are scrambling to come up with these plans because a lot of them, you know, had really narrow approach to climate legislation until a few months ago. I would say Sanders is an exception in that, you know, in the 2016 race, he had a pretty ambitious approach to the climate crisis. He connected it with foreign policy. He, you know, was talking about, you know, a big infrastructure jobs plan. But he's also been pushed to do more. And he has worked with the best emission reduction experts on the global stage who have been pushing an equitable approach to climate financing to come up with the number that he has about how much his plan would spend really redistributing wealth from the north to the south. And he's talking about $200 billion. And that's not a number he pulled out of nowhere. He worked with, you know, the people who I've relied on for more than a decade now to figure out what climate debt actually means. So movements are all over this, I guess, is the answer to the question.
I loved your chapter on constant time, climate time versus constant,
the constant now.
And it reminded me of the eternal now, this mythological idea, mystical idea. I would love for you to expand on any aspect of time and social movements, like just the way that we have to reimagine and renegotiate our time to be involved in social movements, the way that we have to completely revolutionize the way that we understand time during the day and that we relate to time with devices, the time that we have before the end of the world, the time, I mean, any aspect of how, I also think like time and our relationship to the land is really important, but the idea of thinking about time and talking about time and reimagining our relationship to time is something that I think I'm constantly fascinated by and thinking about. And I wonder if you could expand on that.
That's so interesting. And it's so tricky because, you know, the sense of urgency that I think anybody who has taken a hard look at you know, any IPCC report and just wrap their heads around just how little time we have to do so much. It's really hard not to just be in a kind of fight or flight panic about what we need to do, which is, you know, it can be catalyzing, but it can also be dangerous because there is this really rough and dangerous history in the environmental movement, but not only the environmental movement, of sort of using urgency as a way to avoid difficult work, right? Of just like, like we don't have time to deal with our own structural racism or, you know, or we can't even deal with justice at all because look at the climate clock, it's ticking. All we need to do is get to 100% renewable energy. The rest of this is slowing us down. And, you know, I've been having debates about whether it's slowing us down or speeding us up. And of course, in the book, I make the argument that actually it's the narrow carbon approach that designs policies and lends itself to policies that make life harder and more expensive for working people and then leads to backlashes like the Gilets Jaunes movement in France. That's what slows us down. And when you attach climate action to a broader transformation of the economy and society that is actually going to create more time for people because maybe they don't have to work as much, that is going to alleviate stress because the basics of life are covered, like healthcare and housing, that's going to make it more popular. And people are going to fight for that, not because it's better than a future of apocalyptic breakdown like they saw in a Hollywood movie, but because it's like better than Tuesday for most people, right? And that's a fact that a lot of environmentalists have missed for a long time because, you know, let's be real, like the environmental movement is a pretty middle-class white movement filled with people whose lives are pretty good who are scared about the future, right? It isn't filled with people whose lives are tangibly crap right now.
As a feminist, I mean, I see that intersecting very profoundly because of the way that our society is developed in relationship to a male understanding of time and capitalism. And I should say patriarchal, not male. But I think, like, you know, a woman's relationship to time is so different. I mean, especially just based on biological time, you know? Do you have these conversations about the overlap between the feminist movement and this aspect of the environmental movement?
Well, I definitely think a lot about the intersection of violence against women and violence against the land and the sort of dominance-based logic that I think is at the heart of the crisis that we have, and really just a hatred of any reminder of interconnection and dependency, right? And I think that, you know, I often thought, you know, when I had my child and had that experience, I only have one kid, and I became a mother late in life, but I remember having a moment when, you know, you're just like, I remember nursing my son and just thinking, oh, I get it. I know why they hate us so much. Where it's just like, we are living reminders of interdependence and dependency. And if, and you know, it's a beautiful thing. Like, none of these babies are complaining about it. But if you have a worldview that fetishizes the individual who succeeds all on their own and is able to be the sort of triumphant singular great man dominator of people and the natural world, then any reminder that actually we all come from systems of interdependence, whether it is the bodies that we come from or the earth that we come from, like, you need to actually stomp that out, you know? And I think we see, you know, that just that hatred in some of these loathsome figures on the world stage right now. You know, Trump, obviously, you know, whose personal background, you know, comes from raiding women in Miss America contests. And it's kind of interesting, like, what a common theme that is of some of the most powerful men in the world today. Mark Zuckerberg started Facebook raiding women. But, you know, Jair Bolsonaro, you know, like, I thought that moment, you know, around where he's like saying, like, the Amazon is our virgin to, you know, rape and defile, not your virgin. And, you know, calling the Europeans colonialists and imperialists for daring to say that he should do more to protect the Amazon. And then, you know, Macron goes after him, and he goes after Macron's wife, you know, for her looks. So the whole thing is just such a cesspool of this, of really hatred of the earth and hatred of women. So I think about it a lot. And it's one of the things that I think is, you know, just I referenced earlier, like, we don't really have a left. And by that, I mean, you know, we have a lot of powerful movements that are focused on what sort of looks like a single issues, even though there are brilliant people in all of these movements who have them, who themselves have a holistic analysis, you know. So we have a powerful women's movement, and we have a powerful racial justice movement, and a powerful migrant rights movement, and a powerful climate movement. But it's really hard to get folks to work together and agree on a sort of a holistic vision and analysis. So it is worth remembering that, you know, the Bolsonaros and the Trumps of the world have a holistic analysis. You know, they have no trouble connecting the dots and seeing the connections, which is terrifying.
You mentioned these various world leaders, but you've also, as you say, had a chance to travel to different parts of the world where the movement infrastructure is different, and where the movement infrastructure can stand to remind the powerful about, you know, this more holistic vision. As we struggle to build a movement infrastructure in the US, what have you seen that's useful?
Well, I think, you know, I've spent some time in Latin America, and, you know, I think that I mentioned Ecuador, Bolivia. I mean, these are countries that have sectoral movements that are part of broader umbrellas, right? And sort of there's an understanding, like, yeah, this is the women's part of the movement, and this is the labor part of the movement, and this is the indigenous rights part of the movement. But it's all part of the same movement. And there are, you know, assemblies and face-to-face gatherings where people agree on a way forward. And I don't mean to romanticize it, because it's fracturous and incredibly difficult. But, you know, that is what I think a powerful, you know, social movement and organized society looks like. Even Puerto Rico, I think, you know, has much more movement infrastructure than mainland United States. And it has served them well in the aftermath of Maria in terms of saving lives. The fact that you had communities like Mariana, where there was already, there had been big struggles to have water access, that created a movement infrastructure, a community kitchen, that when Hurricane Maria knocked out the electricity and the water, and FEMA showed up, you know, 2 weeks later with Skittles folks there were, you know, cooking in their community kitchen and serving, you know, 600 meals a day, hot food, you know, also because they had, you know, some farms that were practicing agroecological farming methods. And so they had root vegetables, which grow in a hurricane bunker, right? I mean, they grow underground, so they're protected from high winds. But also, you know, when I was in Puerto Rico 6 months after Maria, that community, which still didn't have water, which still didn't have electricity, except for the solar panels that they'd managed to, you know, get sent and put up, and, you know, elderly people were coming in and plugging in their oxygen machines because this was the only place with electricity, you know, for miles around. They hosted a movement meeting with 60, I think more than 60 organizations, hundreds of people. You had labor, you had the anti-debt movement, you had the women's rights movement, you had all, you know, a network of comedores of, you know, of community kitchens to come up with their vision to how to confront the disaster capitalists that were preying on their island. And it's that kind of movement infrastructure that creates a moment like we saw, where suddenly the whole island is in the streets and they're overthrowing the governor. I mean, that began, the spark was the emails, but it was actually started earlier than that. And this is a part of the story that a lot of people don't know. And it comes back to maybe this connection around the intersection of many of these issues. But, you know, I often say that whatever the vulnerability is before climate disruption, it is massively intensified afterwards. So if we want to understand how these issues are interrelated, like, just think about any issue and then think about what it looks like when your house is on fire and falling apart. Like, it gets worse. And one of the areas that we almost never talk about is domestic violence, because when communities are stressed and you have these dominance-based patriarchal relationships, well, who gets, you know, a fist in their face? And in the aftermath of Maria, there was a major spike, you know, in all kinds of mental health, suicide, but also domestic violence and femicide. And it reached such crisis levels that feminist groups in Puerto Rico were protesting outside of the governor's mansion because he wasn't doing anything about it. And then the emails leaked. And then you had this massive, massive uprising. So I think you need to build that infrastructure, because things can change really quickly. Right. And, you know, I think there could easily be a moment like that in this, you know, in the U.S. where people have just had enough and have just had it. But the question is, do you have the movement infrastructure to be able to pivot a moment like that into real transformation of the kind that we actually want? Or do you just open up a political vacuum that somebody else can exploit? And I think all too often, because we haven't built this this movement infrastructure, information technologies and social media makes it too easy to get, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in a square in the streets, that we get ahead of ourselves. So we get the people before we have the infrastructure. And then we're like, oh no, what are we going to do? Or we overthrew the government, we overthrew the dictator, and we don't have a plan, you know? So that's what I find exciting, most exciting about the Green New Deal. And we've talked about this before, is, you know, as imperfect as it is, it's as close as the left has been in my lifetime for having an actual plan for the next economy. Lots of blind spots. There's lots of work to be done in order to fill that in. But this is the work we need to be doing.
You argue that we in the United States, we have these various different movements that are more or less one issue movements. And I'm wondering if you're seeing evidence that the Green New Deal and the climate crisis more broadly is bringing them together, and we're developing a coherent left around a Green New Deal idea. Is that something you're observing as you go around the country, or do you think we still have a long way to go before we get there?
So I would say I'm seeing signs of light, and we have a hell of a long way to go.
Okay.
You know, I think there's some really amazing work going on bridging migrant rights movement with the climate justice movement. And let's be clear, this is a big, big hole in the Green New Deal. It doesn't, the original resolution doesn't mention migration. It doesn't mention the rights of migrant workers. It doesn't mention what this would mean, you know, for asylum seekers. And that has to change. And, you know, when there was 7 hours on CNN to talk about, you know, the various candidates' climate plans, migrant rights wasn't mentioned once. Even Julian Castro didn't mention it, although he does have some good language in his proposal. But the reason why that connection hasn't been made more is because migrant rights organizers are the busiest people in the world, and they are in absolute emergency mode all of the time. And resources aren't going to those organizers to be able to make those connections. It's not because they don't know this is connected. I mean, they're working every day with people who have been forced to migrate because they can no longer farm in Honduras or Guatemala. You know, they're the people who understand it most and deepest, I would, you know, in their bodies, but they're not getting the resources they need to be able to just have this sort of excess energy to interface with this debate. And so that's a failure of funding. That's a failure of the mainstream climate movement. But I'm seeing there are some examples of people bridging that, and there's a lot of willingness to do that. I could give other examples of it. But, you know, it was a pretty bleak day when the DNC was debating the resolution about whether or not to have an official all candidates climate debate within the Democratic primaries. And the main arguments marshaled against it was it isn't fair to migrant justice organizers. It isn't fair to women. It isn't fair to the movement for Black lives. And, you know, that was allowed to stand. And by the way, it wasn't those movements making those arguments. It was, you know, Biden surrogates making those arguments, but using this sort of politics of division. And it just, the fact that they were able to get away with it is a signal of how much work we need to be doing at the movement level, because obviously all of these issues are interconnected. But it was pretty sad when that happened.
My question is kind of along the lines of this, like thinking about the hegemony of social movements and what is just considered kind of normal, run-of-the-mill, what we can and can't do, what we can and can't say. The way in which this book confronts and thinks about ideology and identity politics around this and what we need to do as far as like even in cultural studies to understand how we can change the imagination of a lot of social movements is really fascinating. And that you brought up Saeed, I thought was just the greatest thing ever. I was like, this is exactly, I think, what Stuart Hall had in mind when he was thinking about cultural studies and how it could really have an impact on what's happening as far as social movements and social justice is concerned. And then what happened with the field kind of deteriorated a little bit. But I would love to hear a strategy for changing ideology in this area. It's like, I think that what Greta did in saying, in sleeping in a tent and staying and not wanting to travel, in her confronting people and saying, you know, I don't want your sympathy. These little breakthroughs, even in Florida with the way that the youth were protesting against gun violence there, I saw a little glimpse of a break in hegemony, you know? And I wonder if you can speak to how we can maintain that and move forward and build those moments.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is crumbling. I think there's just such a huge generational shift. And, you know, I think the most radical thing Greta has done so far was at her speech at the UN when she talked about the fairy tales of endless growth. How dare you? And I mean, that was huge and really, really resonant for people. I see such a tremendous shift from when, you know, as you know, I've been making these arguments for a while, and the book spans 10 years of writing. And when I started talking about, like, guys, it's about capitalism. It's you know, the reason we haven't done this is not human nature. It's because we have the worst historical timing that this collective crisis lands at the, you know, ascendant moment of the neoliberal project. 1988 is when Hansen testifies on Capitol Hill. IPCC is formed in 89. The Berlin Wall is falling the same year. Francis Fukuyama is declaring the end of history. I mean, it is. And so for me, as somebody who's, you know, when I was writing The Shock Doctrine, just sort of tracking very closely, like the rise of this, you know, this fundamentalist, free market fundamentalist movement that has used all kinds of dirty and violent tricks in order to overcome the fact that there's been huge opposition to their worldview at every stage, to then hear in the New York Times, oh, it's human nature that we just only think short term, you know, it's just maddening. And so it's to me, it's very, very important to out the ideology and say, like, no, you are equating a certain a specific ideology that was imposed with blood and fire around the world with human nature. Not all humans are like this. There are humans who know how to think seven generations in the past and seven generations into the future. Humans are complicated. We are selfish. We are short-sighted. We are generous. We are empathetic. You know, we're a mess. And different systems that we live in light up different parts of ourselves. And we have been living in a system that has been actively suppressing the best parts of ourselves and telling us the kind of worst, most sort of narrow individualistic parts of ourselves are actually going to create the conditions for the best possible good. And it turns out that was absolute bullshit. And so I'll give you just an example of this, but I think the saddest part of the tour so far with this book was I went to Chico, California, and to Paradise. So Paradise is still, you know, there's very little in Paradise. It's very strange now because they've cleared away most of the debris. But it looks weirdly like a campsite. Like you have all these plots that just have sort of fresh mulch, and they're sort of subdivided because they're lots. And then, you know, 10 miles away is Chico, where 20,000, you know, they describe them as climate refugees, arrived after the campfire, the largest fire in California history. So we're coming on the 1 year anniversary of that fire. And in the first few months after, when Paradise was burned to the ground and several other communities were decimated and these 20,000 people poured into Chico, landed in all places a Walmart parking lot, which is often the ground zero in so many of these disasters. I'm sure some of you heard, and you may have covered it on the show, like the incredible mutual aid network that sprung up in Chico after the campfire. And all of these organizers who provided, much as in Puerto Rico, provided food, provided clothing. People opened up their homes. They said, yes, your entire family and your dog, come on in. I don't know you. I don't care. We're in this together. And it was beautiful solidarity of the kind that we know happens in the aftermath of almost every disaster. This is how people respond to their neighbors in pain or strangers on the other side of the planet in pain. They want to help, you know, whether it's the, you know, Haiti earthquake or the Asian tsunami. I mean, you see these outpourings of donations, which is just the financial way of people saying, I want to help. And then you also hear these incredible stories, like after the Asian tsunami, of, you know, communities that had been so divided along religious lines, just all of that disappearing and people just saving each other. But what's devastating about what's happening in Chico is that, so that's the part of ourselves that all of that disappearing and people just saving each other. Crisis lit up in that community, that people wanted to help. They wanted to be generous. But then they live in a system that highlights scarcity, that allows, you know, rampant profiteering. So somebody who opened their house to a bunch of strangers finds out that lots of people are making a killing doing land flipping. They find out that their rent is being hiked. Their cost of living is increasing. And because we live in a car culture, there are many thousands more cars on the streets and people are starting to get into car crashes. And the whole society just becomes stressed because there's no help. There isn't the sort of mental health support that they need. There is, you know, a culture of, you know, intense winners and losers. Then there's this strange hierarchy that comes up. Who's a deserving homeless and who's an undeserving homeless? Because people who were not made homeless by the fire, but were homeless before the fire, start coming to the mutual aid centers. And so then people say, what are they doing here? Right? We're only interested in helping the deserving homeless, the people who just lost their house. And the whole thing just starts getting really ugly. But is that because humans are, you know, short-sighted and mean and selfish? Or is it because we're complicated and there are different ways of organizing society that will encourage different parts of ourselves? And I just saw that sort of that tug of war playing out in this community that really, really, really wanted to do well. And everything conspired against them to just kind of put them back in those individualistic boxes.
Can I build on Rebecca's question around Stuart Hall and around sort of building counter-hegemony and ask you very directly about the work that you do? Because you've always been a very reflective cultural worker. You move across forms of intellectual activity, from, you know, No Logo to The Shock Doctrine to a feature film which you made with Avi Lewis, The Take. More recently, this beautiful Message from the Future for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And now you'll be leaving us to go write a lecture for your students. I mean, you're doing a range of different cultural work. And the Stuart Hall idea is, you know, that because of certain kinds of cultural hegemony, for example, race is the modality through which class is lived. And, you know, this returns us to the beginning of the conversation of understanding that in order to have good movement infrastructure, we should understand innately that you can't separate race and class and gender. But in fact, these need to be smooshed together in an understanding that's weaved through the kinds of cultural products that you, Naomi Klein, make. What kind of cultural products are important right now, and is your perch at Rutgers a good place to be doing it from?
Well, I definitely think that, you know, coming back to Rebecca's question about what is happening now with this ideological shift, it really is different. Like, I was starting to say this and then went off on my Chico thing, but you know, when I started making these arguments just a few years ago, there was so much pushback about connecting climate to a broader ideological analysis. I mean, I fought like hell with my publishers because many of them did not want the word capitalism in the title, right? You're just alienating people. Why are you doing this? You know, and now this generation of activists, you know, the folks in their 20s and teens who are in the Sunrise Movement or in DSA, they're 100% ready for the ideological shift. And the more connected and more intersectional the analysis is, the more excited they are about it. They're really not interested in sticking in these boxes. And yeah, it's happened very quickly. And this, I think, relates to this question around time, right? Leanne Simpson, who's an Anishinaabe scholar and artist in Ontario, a really wonderful person who's had a big impact on my thinking, you know, she said to me a few years ago, she talked about punctuated transformation, right? And as a way to sort of live with and hold this sort of contradiction that we can't rush the hard work, that we can't skip the hard work. But at the same time, we know that incremental change is a death sentence. So how do we hold that knowledge? And what she was saying is we need to work towards punctuated transformation, like that if we lay the groundwork right, that there will be moments that will move very quickly. And that really resonates with my experience. And, you know, these moments like what happened in Puerto Rico, where suddenly it seems like nothing is happening and then everyone is with you. And I had a really formative experience in my life when Raji mentioned that this film that Avi and I made in Argentina called The Take, which was our attempt to sort of, I guess, break through that hegemony by just telling a story of groups of workers who, in the aftermath of Argentina's devastating financial crisis, occupied their factories and turned them into workers' cooperatives. So not give a sort of a, this is the 10-point plan, we shall have workers' cooperatives everywhere, but just like, these were not ideological workers. They were workers who needed to feed their families. Their factories were being shut down. Their machines were going to be sold for parts. And they said, we're not leaving. You can't have our machines. If you don't think you can make a profit from it, just let us run it. We don't need a profit. We just need enough money to feed our families and take care of our communities. And so we followed three factories. But so we lived in Argentina for a period of almost 2 years on and off. And being there in this sort of effervescent political moment when this country that was sort of the butt of many jokes in Latin America for being like the most sort of bourgeois of all the Latin American countries, many, many jokes that I won't repeat here about this, but the gist of all of it was, you know, they're not really Latin Americans.
Podcasts aren't regulated by the FCC. You can say whatever you want.
No, it's just, But the gist of it being that this is, you know, this country was written off for not having the same kind of radical tradition as many Latin American countries. And then suddenly something tips and everybody is in the streets and they go through five presidents in 3 weeks and they're banging pots and pans. And so, you know, we don't know when the moment will be when suddenly people are ready for deep change. What we do know is that if we aren't ready for that moment, right, it will go bad. And in Argentina, you know, it sort of was handed back to the Peronists. So yeah, I think that's one way that we can hold this. Like that project, The Take, and also The Message from the Future. I mean, I guess one theme that I've been trying to work with is just trying to overcome this sense that, you know, that we're locked in Margaret Thatcher's story, that there is no alternative to this bleak reality, that sure, it's terrible, like, because there aren't any, we're past the phase of anybody selling this on its own merits as a good thing, right? It, now it's just like, there's just nothing else. The alternative is Venezuela, you know? And so I think a lot of the work is helping people believe that there might be a future that is not following the plot of every, you know, sci-fi movie they've ever seen that shows a version of the future that is just us only, you know, eating our kids, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's a big part of breaking through the ideological hegemony, I think. And any of that work, and, you know, there's been critiques of that short film we did with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, because it is a fairy tale, and it's short, and so it doesn't show all the struggle and all the loss. But I can't tell you the response that we had to it was, it's unlike anything, because people just wept, because they so many people wrote to us and just said, you know, I had never allowed myself to hope that we could build something that might be beautiful.
Part of that vision that you write about in On Fire, that's also in that video, is this idea of private sufficiency and public luxury. And that's kind of sort of the response to the sort of obvious idea that we can't sort of keep consuming all that we want. We can't keep relying on this sort of, you know, Chinese manufacturing machine to satisfy all of our wants at a very low price. And I wonder if you could talk through that vision of sort of, you know, everyone having enough, but there being public splendor for all to enjoy.
You know, this is about how we manage great change, right? Because we are in an era of disruption, and there's going to be a lot more of it, even if we do everything right from here on in, right? We're still going to see warming of minimum 1.5 degrees Celsius, and we are seeing massive loss at 1 degree warming Celsius. So I don't want to gloss over the fact that we are going to be living with huge pain and loss and grief, and we're going to have to find ways to take care of each other in the midst of that, and to find joy in the midst of that. The future is rocky, right? And so I think the point that we are at right now, where the right's response to this is basically hoarding, fortressing, absolutely unmasked supremacist worldviews in the United States. It's white supremacy in India, it's Hindu supremacy in Israel, it's Jewish supremacy. It looks different in different parts of the world, but it isn't a coincidence that at this moment, where whether people admit it or not, they know that something has gone very, very wrong in our home, and that the habitable space for humanity is shrinking, and there will be many, many, many millions of people on the move looking for safety who have a right to it. So how are we going to respond to that? And so I think we have the right's response. Their response is, we're going to look after, quote unquote, our own. We're going to lock you out. We're going to let you drown. We're going to let you die in the desert. And we're going to rationalize this by saying, we're better than you, you know? I don't think we've spent enough time actually looking at the mass murder in El Paso, Texas, at a Walmart. He chose a Walmart. Why did he choose a Walmart? He said why he chose a Walmart in his manifesto. He chose a Walmart that was frequented by Mexicans because he said he knew that we were in an era of ecological breakdown. And he also knew that Americans would not change their way of life. So he needed to kill Mexicans who were shopping at a Walmart because Mexicans can't have the American way of life, because that would be very dangerous. I mean, this is like, I believe we're going to be nostalgic about the era when the right in the United States denied climate change, because the only thing scarier than them denying climate change is them not denying climate change and applying this brutal racist worldview to, you know, resource scarcity. And we are seeing it. We are in it. And look, in Europe, climate change denial is not nearly so strong. Marine Le Pen talks about, you know, the reason why we need to have a France that, you know, fortresses itself from Muslim invaders and so on. She marshals people's ecological fears. So does Matteo Salvini. So we're in it. And so and this idea around public abundance or public luxury and individual sufficiency and investing in the infrastructure of care is going to determine whether or not we hold on to our humanity in the midst of these crises. And this is why I was talking about Chico, right? Like, Chico didn't have the infrastructure to support people's good impulses, where they didn't want to respond with scarcity. They wanted to respond with open arms. They wanted to respond with generosity. But they live in a structure that pits people against each other and says only a few of you can win. So we have to ask ourselves, like, what are the investments that we can make that will make people feel less stressed and less panicked and more able to act on, you know, our better nature? And so we have a lot of research about what makes people feel less stressed and happier. And, you know, it is, it's access to nature. It's, it, you know, public funding for the arts. It's investing in teachers and nurses and, you know, ways of living that allow people to, you know, help each other take care of their kids. I mean, so we have to design for stress reduction in a lot of ways, because the future is stressful. That's something that I think we need to really reckon with.
And, you know, the thing is that the American sort of ideal of everyone having their own lawn ends up being really depressing. And people are flocking to places where, instead of having a lawn, you have a beautiful park to go enjoy.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You know, and this is where, you know, there's so much about the original New Deal that we need to approach with huge caution and warning, because it was, you know, there was so much injustice baked into it. It was, you know, affirmative action for white people, as we know, that so many African American workers were left out, domestic workers were left out, agricultural workers were left out. One of the programs that was most integrated were the programs that provided huge funding for the arts. I mean, the New Deal arts programs, you know, led to a renaissance in African American literature, painting, photography. And the whole ethos of it was everybody has a right to art. And the whole idea of the CCC, of the Civilian Conservation Corps, was everybody has a right to nature. I mean, the legacy of that was 800 state parks. We need to think about what a modern day CCC would be that actually is grounded in indigenous land rights and knowledge. But that idea that, you know, part of what's going to increase well-being is access to nature. Part of what, you know, it's interesting when you read some of FDR's, you know, speeches in this period, you know, he talks about the Depression being not just an economic state, but a psychological state, right? So he's saying this country is depressed. People are depressed. So what is going to elevate their spirits, right? And that's why there was such a strong focus on the arts and access to nature.
I'd love to. I mean, I know we have to wrap it up, but the idea of how looking at art and being with art and poetry and these things do transform our relationship to time. You know, you have to look at them slowly and experience them slowly. And it reminded me of when Susan Sontag put on Waiting for Godot in Sarajevo during the wartime. One of the theater directors was in an interview with her afterward, and the interviewee asked them, why would you ever put on a play in the middle of a war zone when people can't even stand up, you know, and you're risking your life to go out? And he said, there's a misconception that during war, the most important thing is to remain alive. He said, it's actually to remain human in each moment.
Wow. I mean, I think that's exactly true. And that's what we're fighting for now. I mean, we are fighting for holding on to our humanity in a future that is going to be really, really tough, even if we do everything right to lower emissions as much as we can, which we must do. And, you know, when you hear these arguments against a sort of this New Deal, this Green New Deal framework, is like, why are you attaching all of these things that are unrelated to it, you know? And you can't pry it apart. And if anything, we need to add more to it. We need a more holistic analysis.
Yeah.
brilliant, Naomi.
Oh, thank you so much.
You did a fantastic job. And I just have been having so much fun reading the book and just so inspired in my own work by it.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to talk with you three.
Naomi Klein is the inaugural Gloria Steinem Chair in Media, Culture, and Feminist Studies at Rutgers University. You can find her latest book, On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal, published by Simon & Schuster, online at all available platforms. For more on The Secret Ingredient podcast, visit our website, it's thesecretingredient.org, and please subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a review while you're there. We appreciate your support. Raj Patel is the author of A History of the World and Seven Cheap Things and a professor at the LBJ School of Public Affairs. Rebecca McEnroy is a host and executive producer at KUT. And Tom Philpott is the food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones. For KUT, I'm Miles Bloxon. Thanks for listening.
Do brain games really make me smarter? What is all this screen time doing to my brain? How do I protect my brain as I age? Find the answers to life's most and least pressing questions about your mind with the Two Guys on Your Head podcast. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts.